Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds, the associate producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, January 15th, Joe was joined by a former U.S. Army officer and State Department diplomat who taught at Bard College for 6 years and is now a senior fellow at Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Ambassador Fred Hoff, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, Mayor of the City of Albany, New York, Kathy Sheehan, and Wall Street investment banker Mark Whitman.
Hearing yesterday, and it was, I don't think I read an article about this, and I think I read about 20 of them, and I don't think I read one that didn't use the word contentious, like this one. During a contentious hearing, Republicans rallied to the defense of Donald Trump's pick for Pentagon chief as he faced tough questions about allegations of misconduct and his views on women. Democrats assail Hegseth as too divisive and inexperienced to run the Pentagon. And he was hammered yesterday by the Democrats. It was a hearing that lasted 5 hours before the Senate Armed Services Committee, an early test of Republicans' loyalty to Trump as lawmakers take on the incoming administration's slate of unconventional cabinet picks. Pam Bondi is currently in the hearing right now for as Trump's pick for Attorney General. So that confirmation hearing is going on as we speak. On Tuesday, it was shown that they were delivering a resounding Republicans were up to the task of defending Hegseth, delivering a resounding defense of his selection, which has been plagued by claims of misconduct ranging from an alleged sexual assault in 2017 to accusations of financial mismanagement, excessive drinking, and sexism in his previous jobs, all of which he denies and said is a smear campaign. Those allegations had fueled worries within the party that the 44-year-old former Fox News personality might not muster the votes needed to win confirmation. But by the end of a hearing void of Republican dissent, Hegseth appeared to have cleared those hurdles. A big one was Joni Ernst, the Republican from Iowa, who said in an interview Tuesday that she would vote for his nomination. So that was a big one because she had been outspoken both on sexual assault as well as the running as a member of the armed forces, that she was had initial concerns, but now she is going to vote for Pete Hegseth. Oh, Fred.
Well, Joe, I watched excerpts of the hearings yesterday. I'm not enough of a glutton for punishment to be able to watch the whole thing, but I came away with two conclusions. Number one is a conclusion I had already reached: is that Pete Hegseth is not remotely qualified to be Secretary of Defense. But the second conclusion I reached was that the advice and consent function of the United States Senate is badly broken. Down through the years, I've known several secretaries of defense: Cap Weinberger, Frank Carlucci, Dick Cheney, Bob Gates, Leon Panetta, Chuck Hagel. None of these folks.
Name dropper.
None of these folks. None of these people was without fault or immune to error. But they were impressive people who had done important things and accomplished a lot before taking over the Pentagon. Even if Pete Hegseth had absolutely no personal conduct-related issues, he would still not be remotely qualified for this position. He's neither led a large organization, and he's not established himself, to say the least, as an authority on defense-related issues. Instead, he's established himself as a culture warrior, which is about the last thing in the world the Pentagon needs right now. As far as the Senate's concerned, I think neither side acquitted itself well yesterday. Occasionally, but it seemed almost by accident, a relevant question was asked of the nominee. But key issues were largely avoided. What does the U.S. have to do to defeat China militarily if war is thrust upon us? How should our procurement process be revised to place 21st century weapons like drones into the hands of our soldiers? What do we have to do to fix our recruitment system and make military service more attractive to young Americans? How should we deal with escalating suicide rates in our active duty ranks and among our veterans? To what extent must spending on defense increase to meet our self-defense obligations? And how can any increases be squared with other priorities? What roles can our allies play in helping us meet our defense objectives? Drawing Mr. Hegseth out, trying to draw him out on these issues, would have demonstrated his lack of qualification. But Republicans were content to give him a free pass and declare him to be a breath of fresh air. And Democrats, abysmally, by and large, were content to focus on womanizing and drinking. And it just strikes me that what Democrats and Republicans seem to have in common these days is a lack of interest in governing this country.
Mirshi?
Well, I'm old enough to remember John Tower.
Yes.
Who was accused of womanizing and drinking and was not confirmed by the Senate. And I concur. I think the substantive questions about whether this individual is actually qualified. I mean, I have such tremendous respect for our military. And when I am speaking with veterans or talking with Gold Star families, Blue Star families, those who have relatives who are serving and those who have paid the ultimate sacrifice, I feel obligated to them to ensure that they have the resources that they need in order to deliver on the mission for that they've been handed, protecting us. And so I think it's a very serious and important position. And I think at a minimum, I can't think of those generals in the room, the men and women who are responsible for the men and women below them in the military, having to navigate what I think will be a very chaotic governance of the Pentagon.
Judy?
Oh, the Senate confirmation hearings are something of a farce. I mean, it's political theater. I agree with Fred. I would have loved to hear the answers to a lot of those questions. I would have loved to see Democrats especially ask some specific questions. You know, I heard one exchange where someone was asking him the exact number of people in each branch of the military. Well, all right. You know,
yeah,
he didn't
gotcha.
Know. Yeah, you know, it didn't. I would have loved to know more, though, about his relationship with the president-elect. What kind of counsel are you going to give him about how to deal with Syria, about how to deal with, you know, the shipping channels in contentious seas? I mean, what is your relationship with him? Are you just subservient to him? Will you feel comfortable expressing your opinion about something else? Although I really don't think he has opinions about anything else that are substantial. I think he's an empty suit. So what is the purpose of this? He's going to get approved. The Democrats are trying to get on record the fact that he has a troubled past and he won't own up to it. I would like him to explain to me why he, at one point in his life at least, did not believe women should serve in active duty roles in the military. Tell me why. Ask when, where, how, and why questions. Fred, I think, should be on the next confirmation hearing panel. I'd love to see some real reporters ask some questions and not leave it to the politicians, because they are woefully inadequate when it comes to vetting people who are going to run our country.
Mark Wibben, and the only one we didn't get to talk to before the break about the Pete Hegseth nomination.
I saw something recently that said that when Kennedy initially called Robert McNamara to be his Secretary of Defense, McNamara said, "I'm probably not qualified enough to fulfill the role."
He was only running Ford.
And I no matter what you think of his political legacy, the qualification issue, I think, is pretty stark contrast to Pete Hegseth. A lot of what's been said, I think, is also what I hold to be true in this case. I think the Democrats did a lousy job of providing opposition, a lot of showboating, and frankly, at the expense of actually real probing questions that probably would have been more likely to throw Hegseth off his stride. The problem I have is I actually don't mind somebody making a big jump in their resume. I've seen it done, and I've seen it done successfully many times. And I'd offer this. If I told you that Pete Buttigieg was going to be President-elect Kamala Harris's secretary of anything, this room would probably cheer, even though we could think of jobs that he didn't have a lot of experience for. So I don't mind big resume jumps. I also actually don't mind I don't mind people reforming themselves. Well, Hegseth served in the military. He claims that caused him some dysfunction in his personal life, and I think we should be willing to provide people, so long as they show the evidence of it, the grace that sometimes people go awry and they come back. So that's not even what gets me here. I do think the problem with Pete Hegseth is you can draw a through line in terms of his views about women and minorities, and unfortunately the through line about women in the military goes through to how he's apparently treated women, at least if we believe his mother's assessment of him, of his behavior the first time out. And so, too, I mean, Hegseth has publicly criticized General Charles C.Q. Brown, who's chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, basically alleging that he was appointed due to the fact that he was black. Hegseth had no evidence for this, but he stated it publicly. He's also said that Admiral Lisa Fraschetti, who's Chief of Naval Operations, so too got her role just because she's a woman. So I frankly think it is a profound mistake to put this guy in as Secretary of Defense. The one, you know, potential sort of ameliorating factor in all this is that the organization of the Department of Defense is huge and has a tremendous amount of institutional inertia. And one hopes that over the next 4 years, that's enough to protect it from folks like this going too awry. But we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, and unfortunately, inertia is also a problem.
Yeah.
With the Department of Defense, because procurement reform is essential if we're going to be able to compete successfully with our near competitors abroad, with the Chinese and with the Russians. A key thing here, apparently the Deputy Secretary of Defense designee, whose name escapes me at the moment, is a person of considerable accomplishment, and that's the person who will actually be running the building in terms of management. But I think if we're going to wait to see some real leadership from Pete Hegseth as Secretary of Defense, it's going to be an awfully long wait.
Anybody else on that?
The other thing I hope, and I was really disappointed in his answers yesterday, is if the president asked him to do something out of bounds, that he's got, you know, the intestinal fortitude to stand up against that. I don't know that this guy does. I suspect, back to the institutional inertia, I suspect there are people in the Department of Defense that would make extreme actions really hard, if not impossible, for the president. So, you know, sometimes, and it's not, I say this glibly, but perhaps the deep state defends us all from ourselves for a while here.
Richard writes, please do not overlook Pete Hegseth's desire to relax the rules of engagement and have an army that will show no mercy to anyone the U.S. deems as its adversary. The word lethal was brought up as many times as how many drinks did you have? Also, using the military to put American citizens in their place was not rejected. That from Richard. We also have this letter from Joel. Senator Elizabeth Warren asked Hegseth when in the 32 days between November 4th, the last time he stated he was against women in combat roles, and yesterday, did he change his mind? Senator Angus King asked him the same question. Senator Duckworth asked very specific questions about basic military matters. They were not answered. Don't blame the Democrats. Then, it might sound minor, but the words we use are important. Do any of you find that using the word warrior instead of soldier is jarring? To me, it feels like using the word warrior is moving us over to the comic book zone and is dangerous in how we all view the real tragedy of war.
Well, I think even more than the comic book zone, it's the world of gaming. And anybody who has seen, whether it's Call of Duty or any of these types of video games, it is quite violent, quite unmerciful, and will resonate with people much younger than I am.
Yeah, and look, as a former green suiter, we're
what
trained.
What is a green suiter?
A green suiter, Army.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
It's a code name for warrior.
You're trained to fight.
Right.
You're trained to fight. You're trained to do everything you can to win on the battlefield, and that may involve piling the bodies high on the other side. That's the nature of the business. Anybody who's been involved in it, with rare exception, finds it very, very distasteful. I've always found that in our political leaders, the ones who have been least inclined to abuse their position and send soldiers and Marines out for repeated deployments, the ones who are least inclined to do that are the ones who have actually served. This is something in Pete Hegseth's favor. He has served, but frankly, I think some of the comments of his defenders in the Senate yesterday were a bit extreme in this regard, saying that having served on active duty, having gotten his boots muddy, this is what qualifies him to be Secretary of Defense. That's nonsense. That's the same thing as saying that any platoon leader, any company commander is qualified to be Secretary of Defense, and that's just not true.
That was Fred Hoff on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, January 15th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, January 16th, Joe was joined by Senior Fellow, Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer, Siena College Professor of Economics, Aaron Pasitti, and political consultant and lobbyist, Libby Post.
So Hamas had agreed to a 42-day ceasefire and hostage release deal, raising hopes that a 15-month war that killed more than 46,000 Palestinians and destroyed much of Gaza could soon come to an end. All right. That's not all you know on this subject, Jim. So tell us what you think.
You know, I'm teaching a graduate seminar in diplomacy in this coming semester, and this, I think, I need to find a way to work this case study in to my syllabus. I need to change my syllabus quickly because it is such an interesting and timely case. Most times when people are saying, oh, you know, well, we need to kind of try diplomacy, they're saying, well, we need to talk instead of fight. But the reality, and we can see this reality in stark relief in this case, is that it's not really a question of talking versus all those other mean and nasty things. They're all rolled into one. And so what has taken a year and 3 months to get us to this point that people who study conflicts and negotiations maybe would call ripe for resolution, is a combination of intense diplomacy and talking, but it's also factoring in use of force, fighting, maneuvering with outside actors, the U.S., Qatar, the Turks, many others as well, the Egyptians, which I want to talk about later, and then also the role of domestic politics, which I think is what we are seeing now. I know that Netanyahu is saying that this holdup right now is because of Hamas, and that could well be partially the case. I suspect the bigger issue is the nature of the politics within his own cabinet, and particularly two of his ministers, Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, who have been against the idea of a ceasefire all along. And in fact, just last week, Ben-Gvir was boasting about how he had torpedoed many efforts at ceasefires up to that point, that it is simply not the way that at least these two ministers and their constituencies want to see this conflict go. And so I think that, you know, it could well be the case that the cabinet will ultimately vote for this, but it's an indication of how very fragile it is. And because we see this deal laid out in various phases, and after phase one, a lot of it is TBD, the TBD part is going to be really excruciating to get agreements on within the politics of the Israeli cabinet and the domestic politics of Israel, but also within the domestic politics among the Palestinians. There's so many unanswered questions. So I think, you know, it's good to see that there's been so much progress made, and it's important that the killing stops. That's important all around, and that hostages are returned, and politically important, but on a humane and humanitarian level, it's important. But I think that this is really thin ice that everyone is skating on.
We get reports just from about an hour ago that deadly strikes in Gaza are continuing despite the announcement of the ceasefire deal. Also, that the White House has announced that they are aware of the concerns raised by the Israeli government and we're working to overcome them. John Kirby, the spokesman for the National Security Council, told NBC, "We're confident that we'll be able to solve these last-minute issues and get it moving." Libby Post.
Well, so I think these two guys who are holding everything hostage, in a sense, you know, there are only two votes on the entire cabinet, but this is Netanyahu walking a very fine line to be able to maintain his government. His government could collapse over this, which wouldn't be such a bad thing, as long as more right-wing people don't end up being in the majority in the cabinet. The people of Israel, for the most part, want this over. They want the hostages back. What I found interesting is that the first phase of the deal, 33 hostages released and hundreds of Palestinian prisoners. Does that mean there are only 33 still alive? I mean, that's the question here. Why only 33? There were 200 and something taken. Some were released last year. Some have been found dead. Some have been killed by friendly fire. And so really, are there only 33 hostages left? That's my question.
I think that what I am seeing is that the estimate from the Israeli intelligence is mm-hmm. that there's 60-something that yeah. are still alive, and but that Hamas doesn't want to give up all the hostages, particularly soldiers, IDF soldiers, in the first phase, because they're still...
But then Israel's supposed to give up hundreds yeah. of Palestinian prisoners, yeah, yeah. many mean, of whom, you know... On the Palestinian side, would like to blow up Israel.
Right.
So, you know, it's
but
like
nobody has a clear
act.
Sense of how many hostages really are still alive.
Well, I know
there's this that is also yes. a major flaw of this or major weak point of this deal. It's like what really
right,
is
because
the
no
deal?
One's, Israel's not getting the information that it needs. You know, there's, you know, who knows? We
there's
don't
no
know.
There's no monitoring
so,
built into yeah. it. No one like third party to really monitor
right,
these
right.
things.
Right. No, there is none. So. My thing is getting everybody released, getting all the hostages released. So I question why it's only 33 yet hundreds of Palestinian prisoners. And, you know, yes to the humanitarian aid. I think all of that has to happen. I think they, in good faith, Israel should stop bombing. Because really, what are they bombing? They're bombing empty shells of buildings. And
well, they
and,
killed 48 people
yeah,
in
killing
the most recent
more people.
Attacks.
Yeah. So, you know, they just need to stop because it's not making it any better. Now, here's what I think might happen. I think the deal will be sealed on January 21st, and Trump will take, because he's already taking credit for it, and Trump will take full credit for it. That's what I think is going to happen. I really, really do, as cynical as that sounds.
Do I have time to piggyback off of that?
Mm-hmm.
That was my first thought was, okay, this is probably too little too late, but you need to start somewhere. So this is obviously mm-hmm. probably the biggest breakthrough in the past 16 years in terms of putting an end to this. Most of what Jim said, I think, is accurate, that we're really on thin ice here. There's a lot of different phases and node points at which there can be disagreement, where the whole thing unravels, and then we're just back to square one. But thinking about Netanyahu and Trump, intelligent foreign policy... intelligent foreign leaders know how to play Trump. It's not a mystery at this point. And... I think Netanyahu is probably he's probably got a very vested interest in delaying so that it can appear that he's working with Trump. He gives Trump the credit for making the deal happen.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, Israel has an even stronger ally with
absolutely.
The Trump administration.
Oh, absolutely.
And so I think there is strategic interests in Israel. And again, independent of the internal cabinet differences that are happening with the Netanyahu government, that more on the macro scale, that Netanyahu has a vested interest in delaying so that he can be seen visibly on the news, shaking hands with Trump, working with Marco Rubio and whoever else is involved, and giving Trump the victory
mm-hmm.
so that
yeah.
he knows he has
mm-hmm.
you know, yeah. an ally that is stronger than Israel's had in a long time.
Well,
and you know, go ahead,
well,
Libby.
Well, I mean, you know, Trump was always on Netanyahu's side. They're
they're
the same person in a lot of different ways. I mean, you know, if Netanyahu's no longer in office, he's going to end up in jail. And, you know, there is that strong possibility because of ethics, and there's been a number of cases brought against him. And, you know, they don't have the Supreme Court that we do that just gave carte blanche to the president to do whatever they want. So, you know, I think that, you know, it will wait, and Netanyahu will bring Trump over for the signing and the whole nine yards. I mean, it's going to
yeah.
be a spectacle, and it's to keep Netanyahu out of jail and to, I mean, Trump's not going to jail. We all know that. But, you know, to keep him up there. We'll see in the long run how well that relationship will last. You don't have the Kushners out front like you did in the first administration.
Yet.
But we'll see. You know,
but, you know, I also think that if we look at the kind of the carrots and sticks of diplomacy, the Biden administration, in some cases, to many people's estimation, not enough cases, but have tried to use some sticks on Netanyahu and say, well, you know, we're going to withhold this, or they ultimately didn't do any of that. And so I think it wasn't taken as credible it wasn't taken seriously at all. But I think Trump is more likely, and his envoy, who went out to Israel and also to Qatar, he, you know, I think he's also providing some carrots. And one of the carrots is something that will become more obvious after Trump takes office and when we get to, if we do get to phase two of this deal. And as those details start to be put in place, I think it will be much more to the liking of Ben-Gavir and Smotrich and their constituencies. And that will have a lot to do with being able to annex parts, formally annex parts of the West Bank, and perhaps to control, physically control parts of Gaza, which has always been denied as a goal. But Smotrich and Ben-Gavir have said out loud time and again that that's what they want. And I think Trump will give them the green light to do that.
Absolutely.
So during the morning of President Carter, we were reminded again and again of the hostage release upon the inauguration of Ronald Reagan. And even though the Carter administration had worked so hard on that and also had great tragedy in trying to end that, it wasn't until the hand was on the Bible that the hostages came out. I bring it up only because I guess this issue of credit is important, although we sort of all knew what happened then. We remember it however many years later as to what happened. And I just wonder, it's a lot of dogs and ponies.
But, you know, I mean, look, Donald Trump, he wanted to get credit for the biggest inauguration crowd
right.
in history, whether that was true or not. I mean, credit and something that matters a lot. That's the currency of his realm. And he learned that from the
big
at the side of Roy Cohn.
Size is the currency of his realm. It's all a size thing for him.
I understand that. I guess what I'm driving at, though, is that in the, you know, of how history looks at it, it sort of saw it for what it was then and saw it for what it was now, and I wonder if that won't be the same case here.
Yeah, I think it's a highly relevant comparison, and I think we'll have a very dramatic day on Inauguration Day here and in the Middle East.
The hope that we had even yesterday, I mean, I know it was always sort of, it was going to be 42 days and we didn't know how long that was going to last and it was always contingent on the votes and so forth. But I think the world did allow itself a moment of what it would be like to have a deal reached and for there to be a peace deal. And so, but that was not enough, at least in the short term, to overshadow these issues that existed, right?
Yeah, well, and remember, this is not the first ceasefire within this conflict. We had one in November, you know, I think just a month and a half
after
the initial attack. And that even almost as soon as it was struck started to show real cracks, and there was hope that, you know, people could jump off of that and have a longer standing deal, and that didn't happen. In fact, it went the opposite direction. Mm-hmm. So that's a cautionary tale, number one. And secondly, I think just in negotiations in general, that it is very rare that you have just kind of a definitive conclusion. Okay, this is over, particularly because this is trying to establish a ceasefire of a conflict that, I mean, it's immediately that its kind of range of negotiation is trying to deal with the conflict that followed October 7th, but it's part of a much broader conflict that is so complex and so deeply rooted, and there's so many different constituencies involved that there's just a lot of moving parts, and that means there's a lot that can go wrong at any moment.
Let's go to a letter from Melinda, who says Netanyahu will wait until Trump is sworn in, just like Reagan and Carter, with Iran hostages. Will that still have its own precariousness as far as being firm, do you think?
You mean when those hostages are released?
Not so much in that, of even if an agreement comes upon everything gets approved, there's still a lot to unfold.
Yeah, I mean, if one of the kind of, you know, the big questions is what is going to be the status of Gaza? How is Gaza going to be governed by whom? And, you know, how is this all going to play out? And that is left completely unspoken to. And, you know, Anthony Blinken has said on the record over the past couple of weeks that, you know, he thinks that there ought to be some kind of deal where Hamas has no governing role and a reconstituted Palestinian Authority, both in the West Bank and Gaza, takes over. And, you know, Hamas, despite the fact that Netanyahu said that the Israelis were going to make sure that Hamas was completely eliminated and could have no role whatsoever, it has turned out that this conflict and the way the conflict has been carried out has actually increased the popularity of Hamas. Before October 7th, Hamas was deeply unpopular with the people in Gaza. And that's not just me saying it. There is data from a highly credible survey, the Arab Barometer, that showed that right before that conflict. And so you have a Hamas that's not only hasn't been eliminated, but actually support of its brand of governance has increased. And that's really highly unfortunate, but it has to be taken into account when you think of how are you going to run this place? Who's going to be in charge? Who's going to monitor it from the outside? What's going to be the role maybe of the Egyptians and others? I mean, all of those are left up in the air, and so that makes it really continuously precarious.
The precariousness the fact that Hamas has suffered extraordinary military defeats, that Iran is largely weakened in all of this. There's another side to this that can play out, and it would rhyme with what happened in the early 1970s with the OPEC embargo of oil to the U.S. The U.S. is now a major player in international energy markets, particularly with oil, but the outsized role that Arab countries in the Middle East have in terms of being able to leverage their power of literally turning the oil spigot on and off can upset an already fragile economy, particularly with the inflation picture in the U.S. So, you know, if Trump goes all in with Netanyahu and that there are these, you know, really large concessions that are opposed in, you know, other countries in the Middle East, then when countries get military defeated, you know, they have a plan B. It's not, okay, we lost, there's an agreement we don't like, so we're just going to throw our hands up and say, well, this is what's agreed upon. I think there's, you know, the next phase of this, even if there's a ceasefire with very favorable terms for Israel, is that, and again, you know, there's the wild card of what's happening in Syria and all of these other complexities that Jim pointed out, you know, do have the potential to lead to increased volatility in international energy and oil markets. And that has the potential, because we saw what happened with inflation and President Biden. Imagine if something like that happened, but on a much larger scale with President Trump, because of the hostility that's brewing in the Middle East and those in the OPEC countries waging economic warfare.
But I agree with all of that, except it's not at all clear to me that the oil-producing Arab states will unquestionably support the Palestinian people.
Sure,
because the reality historically is that many of the Arab states have not, and that they have in one way or another found opportunities to cut out the Palestinians from various transactions, from various deals, from various new relationships that some of these relationships that the Trump people very much want to foster. So I think there's a lot of moving parts there that I'm not sure that those Arab states will fall in line in a way that would be required for them to act
in
together.
Unison, particularly with what's happening in Saudi Arabia with MBS and that burgeoning relationship with the Trump administration. That, sure, yes, the picture is far more complicated than
73.
Right.
Yeah.
And we have to remember that Israel and Saudi Arabia were just about to ink a deal. right before October 7th. And it's what, well, right after October 7th, they were right around that time. And that's part of the reason why this all happened, because Iran, as its proxy, you know, emboldened Hamas to do what they did. Now, Iran is definitely weakened now. Hamas is weakened now. Hezbollah, I don't even know if it still is around. You know, the Houthis are getting pummeled where they are. And so, you know, it'll be interesting to see how that all plays out and whether or not any of the Arab countries will stand up for the Palestinians. And I kind of doubt it. And I you know, I don't quite understand the historical nature of why the Arab countries have turned their backs on the Palestinians for so long. I mean, it started in 48. I mean, why is there that dynamic?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to take it country by country and, you know, historical incident by historical incident. There's not kind of one answer that says it all. But, you know, I often in conversation with people about, let's say, the Egyptian relationship with this Gaza conflict, there's oftentimes an assumption that the Egyptians must be supporting Hamas unconditionally. This is simply not true. And so you have to know a bit, not expecting people to always know it, but you have to know a bit about Egyptian domestic politics to know that the current Egyptian military regime ousted a Muslim Brotherhood freely and fairly elected president in 2013. And following that, declared all members of the Muslim Brotherhood to be terrorists and therefore subject to deportation, arrest, or worse. Hamas is an outgrowth of the Muslim Brotherhood. And so the Egyptian government are not great friends, to put it mildly, of Hamas. And so that's just one example, Libby, of the complexities that intersect on these kinds of issues.
That was Jim Ketterer on the Roundtable Panel on Thursday, January 16th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable Panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, January 17th, Joe was joined by Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Acarius-Kelly, semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, editorial writer at the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz, and the Ulster County Comptroller and the former president and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley, March Gallagher.
The Gaza ceasefire deal, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office said the deal, which is expected to be greenlit by the full cabinet later today, could go into effect as early as Sunday. This is after just 15 months of war, Gazans will dream of returning home. And this has been a very up and down week, of course, where we had a ceasefire agreement. And then there were some last-minute complications, and then finally they came to a resolution in the disputes yesterday with the endorsement of the Security Cabinet, a small forum of senior ministers. The next step is for the full Israeli cabinet of more than 30 ministers to greenlight it, which they are expected to do in a meeting later today, Hamas said on Friday that there were no longer any barriers to the agreement. So we will take that hopefully as very positive news. Vera.
Yeah, I mean, it is an initial moment of relief, I have to say, because there's been so much suffering and death and destruction. So, you know, let's lay out what is ahead. So today, the assumption is that the full cabinet will vote in favor of this agreement. Now, we will likely see that the security minister, Ben-Gvir, will step down and Netanyahu lose part of his ruling coalition. But we'll see how that shakes out in terms of the future Israeli government. But it was an essential deal to sign for to hold the country together because it was 15 long months. So what's going to happen? It is not that the agreement will be put in place immediately and we will see all of the hostages come out and all of the Palestinian prisoners to be released and the Israeli military move away out of Gaza, but it is a step-by-step process and at each step something could go terribly wrong. So the first step will be for three hostages to be released.
Right.
We don't know who they are. We don't know what kind of selection Hamas will make. Will they strategically release, you know, very ill hostages? Will they release younger people? Will they release women? We have no concept and clarity, at least publicly, on that. We also don't know how quickly Israeli forces will pull back from heavily populated Palestinian Gazan cities and move out. We know that surrounding countries have pre-positioned, particularly Egypt has pre-positioned enormous amounts of trucks of aid, shelter, tents, food, fresh water, and borders will open pretty quickly for seriously injured Palestinians to be transferred to hospitals elsewhere. So let's hope it goes well tomorrow as a first step. I would wish it on all members of both Israeli society and Palestinian society that this deal will be put in place effectively and successfully because I don't know what would happen after, you know, if it falls apart.
Right. And it's a 45-day agreement.
Yes.
And so the hope then, of course, is that it goes beyond that.
Yeah.
and it sticks. And but as we have learned just in the last 48 hours, we'll take one day at a time.
Yep. Things could go badly very quickly.
Right. March.
So I've been thinking about this in light of the United States and also listening to the panel yesterday talking about, you know, what happened with the Iran-Contra, you know, the Iran hostages.
Hostages, yes.
Yeah. And I just want to say I think it's been very strong that Biden and Blinken have remained very engaged right to the end. It is not going to be the same sort of posture that was where it's all the credit is going to go to the new administration. Obviously, it's going to be shared between the two administrations. But I do feel like the opposition in Israel is in part, you know, the opposition to the ceasefire is in part in order to drag things out to make sure that Trump is getting some credit for this process. And, you know, it's unfortunate to think that additional lives are being lost at this time, because we don't have the ceasefire in place, and it's really to benefit this sort of political, you know, framework in the United States. And that weighs on me a little bit heavily. But I think it will be a huge relief for everybody. And, you know, I heard this morning on NPR as I was driving in, you know, somebody, I can't remember the commentator, saying, you know, we need to separate these types of crises from what's happening in the United States, right? This is not something that is happening in the United States, but we've taken it on as if it is. And hopefully we can sort of get our feet under us and reposition ourselves in terms of just how gut-wrenching it is in the U.S.
Very
because of the ceasefire. Yeah.
Yes. Jay.
I'm really pessimistic about anything to do with Israel and Gaza. If this holds for 45 days what can happen under this happens, that'll be, you know, a good interim step, a moment of relief for everybody. I don't know if it's going to last much longer than that. You know, we had Pete Hegseth testifying this week, and he was very clear about whether I assume this is the position of the Trump administration and probably the position of Netanyahu and the hawks and the far and the right. And I'm not so sure it isn't a reasonable position that he wants Hamas eradicated completely and thoroughly. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting dynamic to have a peace, you know, to be sort of having a lull, which is all this is going to be, mm-hmm. I think, you know, with an organization that you are determined to wipe out. I think Israel and I think Netanyahu had hoped for a lot sooner than this, a complete and total defeat or surrender. And that is just not going to happen in this space. Mm-hmm. I think one of the sensitive things that's going to happen in the next few days is who's going to come home, what hostages are released. It was an interesting thing I read the other day that a lot of these people are dead. If dead bodies start being delivered,
I
don't think this is going to last very long. Mm-hmm. I think there's going to be a lot of outrage in Israel and, you know, and people here, as you said, you know, this is a war we're sort of fighting over here among ourselves, you know, because it's a perfect right-left, binary thing. It, you know, people are trying to make it into that anyway. The outrage will start immediately. Yeah. So
can I comment on
yeah, we just have about a minute and a half.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
So I wanted to say the pressure on Netanyahu is also very intense, and he will be blamed. So the society is angry in different ways, right? And a lot of citizens in Israel are also really angry at Netanyahu for having dragged it out and not gotten the hostages out. So the anger will be, you know, influencing civil society and voting behaviors. And we obviously know that Netanyahu is on trial at the moment for corruption charges. And there's a lot of fallout, I think, that we will see. And I agree with you. We have a hard time sort of identifying all the strands of rage that we will see. Now, on the question of eradicating Hamas, that may have been a goal, but you can't eradicate ideas.
Yeah.
And you know, Hamas might not exist in the near future as a name, as an organization, and certainly a lot of Palestinians are enraged with how they were used as human shields in this organization. But the idea of what Hamas stood for will live on because we have so many young people who lost all of their family members in the bombings, and so that is the most difficult thing to overcome.
Just before the break, and kudos to Vera because she brought us up right to the exact second I needed her to read. She hit the post, as we say in radio. But you were talking about this idea of, you know, eradicating Hamas. And is there anything else you wanted to add to that?
I wanted to say, obviously, I said eradicating Hamas as an idea is impossible. And in that sense, the Israeli military has said that all along. You know, we can get some of the leadership and we can do that. But now it's time to move on to stage two, which is figuring out what the future holds. And I have to say, I agree with everything you said, Jay. It's a very difficult time and we may not want to be overly optimistic, but we should be optimistic about one thing. When you look at negotiation literature and when you look at creating a post-war reality, the most successful realities emerge when both sides, in essence, lose and don't achieve all of their goals. Mm-hmm. So we are in this position. So I'm slightly more optimistic that we can find a path forward than you just expressed, although I see all of the strands that you laid out. But it has. We have to see an election in Israel that creates a new, more hopeful future that protects, you know, members of Arab Bedouins in Israel, Arab citizens in Israel, also creates a sustainable future in the West Bank, because the West Bank has been, the population in the West Bank has been treated horribly as well, and we have now a complete Swiss cheese operation, which we had, you know, in essence before, but now it's gotten more difficult. The fact that Israeli military has permanently taken over the Golan Heights and now is mucking in Syria is also problematic to me, you know, expansionist in that sense. And I'm just very, based on the literature and the studies from other cases in the world, we have seen that this is a moment where we might have some positive outcome for the future.
We, during the break, learned that the Supreme Court has upheld the law to ban TikTok if it remains under Chinese ownership. This is not a huge surprise, but the ban would take effect as soon as this weekend. Donald Trump has asked the Supreme Court to delay TikTok's ban for sale law to give him an opportunity to act once he returns to the White House, which, of course, happens on Monday. So this is a waiting and seeing a little bit. But the Supreme Court again on Friday refusing to block a federal law that would effectively ban TikTok in the U.S. The justice's order was a blow for TikTok, prohibiting its operation in the lead up to Monday's inauguration of President Trump, who had promised to, quote, save the app.
You know, I don't like to be cynical when it comes to our president-elect, but you know, the potential irony of all this is really interesting. So American companies get in trouble sometimes when they get caught doing this. But one of the realities of doing business in China is there's a lot of bribery that goes on, over at the Times Union, as an editorial board, have often described campaign contribution, the whole campaign contribution system, as legalized bribery. And I would suspect that one of the reasons that Trump would like a delay is to soak TikTok for all it's worth in terms of campaign contributions and other largesse to friends and loyalists and so forth. And then there will be a decision to save this app.
That is very, very cynical, yeah. And yet I have nothing to disprove it.
I have an even more cynical perspective. Yeah. I think they're angling to sell it to Elon Musk. I think he's going to bail out TikTok. I'm really worried about that.
Well,
he's expressed he's interested in it.
That on the show yesterday of that this sudden turnaround from Donald Trump on this issue does seem to go hand in hand with the ever presence of Elon Musk.
I mean, I think this just speaks to us needing digital antitrust more than ever. Lina Khan was doing that at the Federal Trade Commission. I'm so bummed out. We're going to miss her so much, and we're not going to see that level of enforcement or any enforcement of antitrust laws under Trump. And, you know, you have these mega enterprises that are running the show. Half, you know, a bunch of them are going to be sitting on the stage during the inauguration. It could not be more obvious.
There are going to be a lot of kids this weekend ticked off. TikToked off.
TikToked off.
Yes.
Well, Biden has said he's not going to. I think he has said he's not going to do this.
Right.
He's not going to enforce it, but it's only in his hands for one day. And, yeah. And I'm reading that Trump could delay for 90 days enforcement. But, I mean, at some point, he'll probably just use that to gain contributions
and turn it
over to somebody he likes.
That was March Gallagher on the Roundtable panel on Friday, January 17th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. The lockbox is open, and you can help support WAMC by going to wamc.org. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.